You're listening to The Takeaway with Melissa Harris-Perry. From WNYC and PRX in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
This is Rise Above by Black Flag, released in 1981. And while mainstream audiences at the time mostly covered their ears, punk found an audience in many young adults who wanted to reject commercialization and capitalism. Now, for a long time, punk bands and audiences appeared to be overwhelmingly white. But black people were always part of the scene. The 2003 documentary, Afropunk, followed four black punks and showcased what being punk meant to them. Challenging racism, just as much as it meant challenging the mainstream.
It's not just a trend or a style. There's a cultural validity in it for me.
The documentary was directed by James Spooner, a black punk musician and artist. He went on to co-launch the Afropunk Music Festival in 2005, which has become a global event. Spooner grew up in a very small, very white town in California, and his new graphic memoir is called The High Desert, Black, Punk, Nowhere. And he joins me now. Thanks for coming on The Takeaway, James.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's just get some terms together here. First of all, what is punk?
Oh, geez, that's like, those are fighting, it's a fighting question. You know, to me, punk is obviously a music genre, but it's also a community and culture. You know, within that community and culture, which is now over 40 years old, there are many, many factions and varieties and subgenres. So, you know, we're going to use punk, I guess, as like an umbrella term for this this community.
And yet, Afropunk, although I think now, you know, in parlance, right, it's enough of a phrase, but when it first emerges, when you first give us Afropunk, it feels initially like, wait a minute, can you be Afro and punk?
I think when I first heard the word Afropunk used as, you know, just in conversation, it really resonated with me. I mean, for obvious reasons, being black and punk, but yeah, I don't think there's a contradiction. It's like, it's not the same as saying like white rap, you know, we're saying black rock and roll, you know, like this is clearly comes from our legacy.
I love that it resonated with you and that you immediately felt the Afro and the punk. Tell me what it was about punk, both as a musical genre, but more broadly, as you've defined it here, as community and culture, that really appealed to you as a teen in the 80s?
You know, I think when I found punk, I was 13 and I was a skateboarder. And in the 80s, punk was the soundtrack for skateboarding. So, you know, it was just part of that community. But, you know, I think being a kid and hearing the anger and the angst that these other kids in these bands were singing / screaming about, you know, it resonated with a part of me that I didn't even know was there. You know, I can look back as an adult and see like my parents were divorced. My father wasn't around much. I lost a sibling due to the divorce and her moving back with her mother. Like there's just all of these things that I had anger about that I wasn't talking with anyone about or anything. So there was probably a desire to be heard, acknowledged, you know, probably a friction with authority that I just didn't have the words to be able to articulate. But punk did that for me.
I recently had a conversation with Ebro Darden. You know, he said to me that, you know, so often the music tells us what our young people are thinking, right? How they're hurting, what gives them joy, why they're angry. And that, you know, we get into a position of judging the music because it's somehow not our music, right? And I hear that resonating in what you're saying to me about being a kid who was feeling angry.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that there's something so tangible about punk rock and in a lot of ways hip hop as well, where the youth movement, like when you find out that the kids on these records are actually teenagers, you know, it's like, oh, I can do this too. They're speaking for me, not from the past, you know, like they aren't these well-honed pop stars that have been doing it for, you know, since they were eight and now they're in their late 20s or whatever. Like, these are kids just like me, and they're talking about things that I am experiencing as well, and it feels authentic.
Let's talk about the memoir. Why a graphic novel?
You know, I came from film, and so I had like a understanding of script writing. I had an understanding of blocking and framing. I've been a tattoo artist for 13 years now. And over those years, I've really honed my illustration skills. I was also a DJ for many years. So I even have a understanding of pacing that I feel all of those things combined kind of created this perfect storm for me for this kind of project. Something that I didn't really anticipate that I would ever do, but having, you know, kind of like when I first heard the Ramones, I was like, oh, I could do that. You know, when I first read a memoir graphic novel, immediately clicked. Oh, this is a way that I can tell my story and I can do it myself. And I don't have to rely on the film industry or, you know, get a green light from anybody. I can just do this. And why wouldn't I?
Black Punk Nowhere. That's the subtitle, but it's not nowhere. It's Apple Valley. Why is that? why is Apple Valley feeling so nowhere?
If you had ever been to Apple Valley, but I mean, you know, Apple Valley is a small town, and it's the kind of place that you would only know if you were driving from Los Angeles to Las Vegas and you needed to get gas. You know, people live in those towns where you just stop to get gas. Mm-hmm. And there's even punk rockers there. It is something that comes up when I stop at a gas station or something. And, you know, there's a clerk there that has to live somewhere near here. And what is out here? Because so many of those places are just like a gas station on the side of the freeway. And then you keep going, you know? Apple Valley is that place, you know? It's not even that place. It's the place next to that place.
Let's pause here. More with James Spooner on The Takeaway in just a moment.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. I'm talking with James Spooner, the creator of the documentary Afropunk, about his new memoir, The High Desert, Black Punk Nowhere. There's a fellow Apple Valley punk in the book, Ethan, and you actually know Ethan a bit, but then it turns out you maybe don't know him so well. Can you tell that story a bit?
Well, yeah. So, you know, when I first found punk, I met another Black punk. So I felt like this is a place where I could be. The first punk I met was Black, right? But his best friend, since he was in kindergarten, was part of a white power family. Like, they have Nazi flags on the walls, and they're white supremacists in the most extreme sense of the word. But he was just a kid, you know, he was 13, 14 years old or whatever, and he's just trying to figure himself out, you know? So when I met him, I was already a little wary because he was a racist skinhead. But he was cool with my friend, and he was very nice to me. And what I watched him go through over the months that we hung out was this kind of grappling with how you square having now two Black friends, but also espousing these white power beliefs, even if it's just like in dress or, you know, the unfortunate house that he lived in, you know? So in the book, I didn't want to just have these mustache twirling villains, but I wanted to make them real humans and give the reader a sense of like what might be going through the mind of a 14-year-old Nazi skinhead.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I pause on it a bit because obviously we're in a moment where, because we've made it possible to arm an 18-year-old with an AR-15, you know, all that teen angst and failure to make good sense as a teenager now suddenly has these deadly implications. It is a reminder that it doesn't have to, right? We could just let young people sort of make mistakes in a young people kind of way and have time to grow up and be different.
Well, I mean, I think it's all about exposure, you know, and for Ethan, he had an experience where he was cornered by another skinhead and said, like, look, you can be down with us, but you can't be down with them, meaning me and my friend Ty. He had to look at himself and realize that, like, actually, these black kids are my best friends, not some rando who also is wearing a swastika, you know? And I think that for so many people who are prejudiced in various ways, it's because they haven't humanized the people that they are prejudiced against. And if they have the opportunity to meet those people as humans, it's like, oh, you're gay, but you also have these same issues that I do. You're a person of color, but you are also struggling with the same things I am, or whatever, you know, like, or you also like the same things to relate to beyond our differences of race or sex or gender or whatever, you know?
You have a mother who is white, but you really write about this in some ways that I don't know that I've always read, but you write, love is not enough for a white woman raising a black son on her own. Maybe reflect on this a bit with us.
You know, my mom's character in this book is something that I think touches a lot of people, because she obviously is doing her best. She's trying. She's loving. She's not neglectful in this, in any kind of abusive way or whatever. But she came from a different generation. And I think that she came from the all you need is love generation. I think that we've, now that there have been so many mixed race kids who have grown up and had the opportunity to talk about the successes and failures of their parents, I think that we as a generation of parents ourselves now, I think we're better suited to say that if you were to be in an interracial relationship and have a mixed race kid, that it's like the responsibility of the white person to make sure that that mixed race child has access to the people of color beyond your just immediate family, you know, because there have been no shortage of books, no shortage of talk shows, no shortage of whatever to like discuss this, you know. I think it was just my mom's failings were in that she was part of a generation that thought that all you have to do is love your child and they'll be fine.
And, you know, I even get why that's radical, right? To say that, the ways in which that seems to push against racism, but also allows a certain kind of lack of awareness about what it takes, right, to be fully strong enough to be our full selves, right?
My father is an immigrant. He comes from the Caribbean. And most of my life, I knew him living in the United States. When I was in my 20s, he was living back in the islands, and I went to go visit, and we were walking around, and he was just speaking in French to everybody, mm-hmm. like in patois. And my mind was blown. I had no idea that he spoke another language, you know? And I'm like, you know, I took high school French. You never helped me with that, like never came up, you know? Like, I know that there are different kinds of French, but still, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, my partner is Korean, and she's half Korean. And she was not raised to speak her language. Like, her mom was embarrassed to have her learn the language. And it's this very American thing of where white is the gold standard of normal and everything else is subpar, right? So, you know, in both mine and my partner's situation around language, it's like, wow, we missed out on a part of our culture that connects us to our culture.
I have a final question for you, James.
Yeah.
Today, with the growth, you know, we're talking about growing and changing collectively and individually, but for you now, what does Afropunk mean?
That's a loaded question, I think, because Afropunk, when I started it, was a film about being a Black person in a white community, namely punk rock. And as I started doing events and stuff around it, it was still very underground. It's still very punk rock, you know? And it was just centering the Black experience. But now Afropunk is a brand owned by a billionaire, you know, and run by the Essence Corporation. You know, it's very mainstream. So Afropunk is only relevant. I mean, I don't mean to say that Afropunk, the brand, doesn't have value. It does have value, but it doesn't have punk values. And it's really important to know the difference. Just like everything in the mainstream, its best value, or the reason that it is valuable to the underground, is that it gives it something to reject and to resist against. So now there is a fantastic Black and brown underground that's thriving within the punk scene in a way that, like, had it existed when I made Afropunk, I wouldn't have had to make Afropunk, you know? So I accidentally created this thing that gave the kids a reason to, something to reject and create their own thing, because that's what the underground does, you know? The underground and the mainstream, they need each other. They feed off each other. And it's a constant cycle.
It is a sign of adulthood when you accidentally give the kids something to reject. I'm basically down, like, that should be one's life goal, is to make something that the kids will then reject so that they can make their own thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a long process for me to accept that. But I, you know, I'm also blessed that I'm not wrapped up in their rejection. You know, most of those kids who are rejecting Afropunk are embracing me. And The High Desert is another one of our stories.
James Spooner, tattoo artist, film director, graphic novelist with a graphic memoir, The High Desert, Black Punk Nowhere. Thanks for joining The Takeaway.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.